Well, once a year, we pay tribute to Coast guests who have passed on. In a moment, we will begin our first guest of six. Six guests who have passed on over the last several years, and we will honor them in just a moment. Former Coast guest Benjamin Krem passed away in October of 2016. He was the representative of the Maitreya, the world teacher. Here he is, Benjamin Krem. Back. It's been a while, Benjamin. How are you?
Yes, indeed. Yes, I'm fine. Thank you.
Still speaking around the world?
I am indeed, yes.
Cool. For people who don't know who the Maitreya is, would you describe him? And then, of course, you do know he's controversial, so I'll ask you for a few of those.
Maitreya is the personal name of the head and leader of a group of, from our point of view, totally perfected beings, the masters of wisdom. A group of men like us, who have gone ahead of us in evolution and evolved to a point where they no longer need to be on this planet. But a large number of them remain on the planet to oversee the plan of evolution for the rest of us. The head and leader of that group is the Lord Maitreya. And he holds the office of world teacher and is expected by all the major religions under one name or another. Christians await the return of the Christ. Maitreya embodies what we call the Christ principle, the energy of love. He's awaited by Muslims as the Imam Mahdi. Several of them, the Shiite groups, believe that he is either in the world or expected to be in the world within the next 3 or so years. Hindus await the coming of Krishna.
Yeah.
Buddhists await the coming of Maitreya Buddha. They have his name right. 2,600 years ago, the Buddha made a prophecy that at this time would come into the world a new teacher, a Buddha like himself, by name Maitreya, who by dint of his extraordinary spiritual stature could galvanize and inspire humanity into the making of a brilliant golden civilization based, as he put it, on righteousness and truth. And this is, I believe, the Maitreya Buddha that is expected by Buddhists, although I know Japan very well. I go there every year. And the Buddhists in Japan expect Maitreya Buddha, but they see him coming in something like 650 million years from now. Well, to my mind, they've got it totally wrong. Maitreya is in the world, came into the everyday world from the Himalayas, where he has lived for thousands and thousands of years, and took up his position in the Asian community of London on the 19th of July, 1977, has now reached a point where he can come openly into the world, and we expect this to take place very, very soon.
How soon, Benjamin?
Very soon. I can't give you a date. It might be tomorrow, a week's time, 3 weeks from now, 2 months, any time in the immediate future.
I mean, I know when we talked 4 years ago, it's been a long time, 4 years ago, you know, the word of the Maitreya was starting to get out. Is he well known in Europe?
I don't think he's more well known in Europe than in America.
Okay.
I've had more media coverage in America than anywhere else in the world. So I would think the people in America are probably more informed about Maitreya than anyone. Although the Japanese, although I don't get, because of the language problem, I don't get the same media coverage, the Japanese are tremendously involved. If I hold a lecture in Tokyo, well, I was there in May this year, there are 2,000 people at a lecture.
Well, that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
Now, I've got to ask you this, Benjamin, while we chat this hour, and I may keep you for phone calls for an hour after that. There are a lot of people who do study the Maitreya. They truly believe that he, it, whatever you want to call this, is the Antichrist.
Yeah.
And I know you don't get offended when you get those questions asked.
No, not at all.
You're going to get a lot of those tonight, but I do need you to address that. People believe he's the Antichrist.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, people are completely wrong because they don't know what the Antichrist is. The usual idea of the Antichrist is that there will be some kind of a man who will appear before the Christ, and this is the expectation of Christians, that the Christ will return, although they don't know when or the manner, and they posit the idea that before he comes, will come into the world a man who could be mistaken for the Christ, but he is in fact evil incarnate. He is the devil. He is all the worst possible evil they can imagine. It's their own fears that they project onto Maitreya. The Antichrist is something completely different from that. It's not a man. It is an energy deliberately released into the world to break down the old order. It's in Revelations of St. John, as you probably know.
Yes.
It refers to the release of the Antichrist through the Emperor Nero, who saw that the Roman dispensation could be finished and destroyed to prepare the way for Christendom. It was released again in our time through Hitler, a group around Hitler in Nazi Germany, together with a group around Mussolini in Italy, and a further group of militarists in Japan. And these three forces, the Nazis, the fascists in Italy, and the Japanese militarists, embodied the energy we call the Antichrist. It has been and gone, it has done its destructive work, and prepared the way for the coming of the Christ today. Maitreya, as far as Christians are concerned, is the Christ. And they await him without knowing that he's called Maitreya. They are looking for Jesus Christ. Well, Jesus is a disciple of Maitreya. And 2,000 years ago, Maitreya used the vehicle, the body of the disciple Jesus, to manifest for 3 years, from the baptism to the crucifixion. Jesus made two enormous sacrifices. One was the giving up of his body for the use of Maitreya for these 3 years, and the other to be literally crucified on the cross, which is a symbolic enactment of a great initiation, which in the West is called the crucifixion. In the East, it's known as the Great Renunciation, in which all is renounced, even death, life itself, for the higher life of the resurrected masters.
With this return, Benjamin, of the Maitreya, that could come at any time, why? Why now?
He comes now at this particular time because the masters as a group, quite apart from humanity, have come to an end of a cycle in their evolution which requires them to return to the everyday world where once they lived as ordinary men and women in the world, to show their ability to work on all planes. They have consciousness on all planes on Earth, but to show their ability to work consciously and with control on all planes in group formation. They have done this individually, but they must show their ability to do it in group formation. As their teacher, as their leader, Maitreya comes as one of them. That's the reason for coming at this moment. The other reason is that humanity is going through a tremendous cosmic event. The change from one cosmic cycle to another.
A huge change.
From the Piscean experience into the Aquarius experience. And this goes on over years and years and years. The energies of Pisces began to recede in 1625. The energies of Aquarius began to come in 1675. And by now, they're more or less equal. Not quite, but very near. And the world is divided into two lots of people. Those, not because they're evil, but because they love them, who are holding on to the old ways of Pisces, the greedy, selfish, self-interested, ways of Pisces, and all the structures, political, economic, religious, social, scientific, educational, and so on, are all created under the aegis of the energies of Pisces. But we are now in the early stages of the age of Aquarius. The new energies are coming in and are quite different from those of Pisces.
But you know, Benjamin, with this entire world upside down right now, it is ironic that the Maitreya would arise at the same time.
No, I think it's very pertinent that just at such a time he does come to show us how to handle the situation, how to safely move from the experience of Pisces into the experience of Aquarius. The energies of Pisces have given us tremendous things like individuality, a sense of idealism, devotion to an ideal. But that ideal, because of the marked individuality at the same time, has always been our own ideal. Whatever had to do with ourselves, our family, our group, our nation, our country is right. Right, whatever it does no wrong, and we do no wrong. So we have built in a kind of one-sided view of life, a fundamentalist view of life, and left ourselves no longer open to other points of view. And it takes all points of view to make a world. We're not all thinking the same things, and we're not all at the same point in evolution. And so the world is really an aggregate of ideas and forces, and that has to be given expression. Whereas holding on to one dogmatic viewpoint, whether that be religious, you know, Christian or Buddhist or Muslim or Hindu or Jewish or whatever, is not of benefit to humanity. Neither is holding on to an ideological idea like socialism or communism or democracy or fascism or Nazism. These are mental ideas, and they only confuse. They block the view of life in reality to humanity. So we are all working through a fog of glamour. We don't see life as it really is. And that glamour has to be removed. The masters are people who have in themselves removed all hint of glamour from their emotional makeup, all hint of illusion from their mental makeup, and are perfected. And they are there to show us how to do the same thing, how to become like them, perfect. And in the immediate future, the work of hierarchy is to show us how to safely move out of the restraints and exaggerations of Pisces into the unity of Aquarius. The energies of Aquarius are about oneness.
I understand that.
Unity. But with total diversity, so that they are a unity in diversity, the utmost diversity, the utmost individuality, but all brought together and put at the service of unity.
Are you still in telepathic communication with the Maitreya?
Not with Maitreya, no, but with my own master.
You are? Yeah. Okay. How about Maitreya? Are you in contact with him at all?
I'm in contact with him, yes, but not in a sort of like phoning up sort of way, you know?
I mean, he
overshadows me at all my meetings. He directs the energies through me in our meditation, transmission meditation, which our master has introduced to the world. But I can't ring up Maitreya. I can call on him at any time, but I can't sort of ring him up and say, look, could you do this or that?
Does he have the ability to manifest himself wherever he wants to go?
Yeah, wherever, anywhere in the world at any moment. He is omniscient, he has full consciousness of omniscience, and also omnipresent. You know, it says in the Bible, a little sparrow could not fall to earth, but God would know about it. Well, it's like that with Maitreya. Nothing can happen that he doesn't know about.
Well, there are some that say that he is a proponent of a one-world government. So I'll chat with you about that, Benjamin, when we come right back. Our guest this hour, Benjamin Krem, representing the Maitreya. And we'll also find out what the Maitreya thinks some of the world's most pressing problems are at this time when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Benjamin Krem's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. You know, Coast to Coast, one of those programs that has 7 nights a week live programming for you. I'll be hosting Sunday, first Sunday of the month, with my guest, Dr. Future. That's right. We're going to be talking about some incredible things. And, of course, emerging artists Sunday night as well. Those of you who don't have an opportunity to play your wares, your music on other radio stations, you get your chance on 525. And, of course, Saturday, always manned by none other than Ian Phineas Punnett. Hello, Ian. How are you?
I'm great. I'm just sitting there enjoying Benjamin Krem quite a bit. So
you would have a good time with him.
You know, we did a thing on Theosophy last Saturday night with somebody who I think was very influential for Benjamin Krem, Madame Blavatsky. But I'm really, I'm just sitting here preparing to go to bed and enjoying it quite a bit. Tomorrow night, so I'll keep this short. Tomorrow night, you don't mind if I borrow Gary Patterson for the first time?
No, you two have a great relationship anyway. So
well, we do, but there's a bunch of interesting things developing on the Michael Jackson story. And he, of course, tracks these rock and roll conspiracies. And he has been fairly accurate about all of his predictions so far about what would come out. So we're going to talk to you about what is still on the way based on the experiences of fans of Elvis Presley and Jim Morrison, what we might expect to start hearing next about Michael Jackson coming up tomorrow night in the first hour. And then we'll be talking about Goldman Sachs and just what kind of entitlement do they have? Just kind of some secret deal Goldman Sachs has
in order to
manipulate the markets. We'll talk about that tomorrow night on Coast to Coast.
Okay, get some rest, Ian.
All right, thanks, buddy.
He's always working. We'll be back in a moment with Benjamin Krem on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Benjamin Krem with us. Benjamin, there are some who believe that the Maitreya would love a one-world government. What's your view on that?
No, it is not the plan of hierarchy. When I say hierarchy, I mean our spiritual hierarchy, of which Maitreya is the head and leader. It is not the plan of hierarchy that this world should have one form of government. In fact, they see a multiplicity of different viewpoints, different ways to organize what we call government, the manifestation of all the disciplines and the ways of living and relating which make up our own present world. And they see a refining of all these ways, and they will have some things in common, but they will be quite different depending on their individual destiny, the type of background, how old they are as nations. Older ones and newer ones will be different in style. And some nations are very old. Britain is old. Japan is old. France is old. America is very new.
Mm-hmm.
Russia is very new. And the differences in outlook are the result of this, whether you're old-looking or new-looking, you know, whether you have all the exuberance of youth that America has, but also maybe some of the naivety of youth. And maybe Britain and France and Japan have a wider outlook, a deeper outlook.
Up next, of course, we've got another special guest for you who passed on, Stan Lee. Ian Punnett talked to Stan some time ago, and we'll have that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back to Coast, and thank you for participating in our tribute show. Six wonderful Coast to Coast guests who have passed on. And let me tell you, there were way more than six since I've been doing this program since 2003. Just way too many. And welcome back to Coast. Stan Lee, the genius behind Marvel Comics, passed away this month, and he was 95 years old, November of this year, 95 years old. Back in 2007, Ian Punnett had a chance to talk with him.
Stan Lee of Marvel Comics, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be talked to, but I'm sorry I missed the show about the guy with the horse, with the soul of a horse.
You would have loved it, I'm telling
man.
You. I will say that we've never met, but you've been a friend of mine for years, and I know that you hear that from so many fans out there. There are many more famous hosts who could be interviewing you tonight, but nobody with a greater appreciation for your work than
Well, bless your heart.
I mean that. And I've loved reading about you over the years. I was telling one of your people who had called earlier in the week, and I just said, you know, I've just always been more fascinated with you almost more than your creations. And so I've read stuff about you over the years. I'd love to put it to the test. You got a second?
Sure.
All right. Stan Lieber. Is that correct?
That's right.
Your birthday?
Stanley Lieber. Stanley Martin Lieber.
Now, you wanted to save using Lieber for the day in which you might write something that was of greater import than a comic book. Did you ever?
No, I'm afraid not. See, on the day that I started writing comics, nobody had any use for them. Nobody had any respect for them. And I hated using my real name.
So you kept holding on to thinking, one of these days I'm going to use it. And Stan Lee, of course, kind of, you know, grew from that. And you became the franchise in a lot of ways for Marvel Comics. It's probably appropriate for me to mention some of the most famous, although I don't get to all of them. We all know Spider-Man and the X-Men, Fantastic Four, Daredevil you were involved with, of course.
Oh, sure.
You know, that's one of my favorites, and I even liked the movie Daredevil. Not everybody did, but I was really hoping for Daredevil 2. I thought it was great.
There will be one.
Will there be one?
Yeah, there'll be
okay.
one.
And who else should we mention of the ones you're proudest?
Hulk, Daredevil,
oh, Hulk,
Doctor
of course.
Strange, Iron Man, Thor, Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., the Silver Surfer. We can go on and on.
Well, and Silver Surfer is another one, too. There's so many of these which I think, you know, Hulk was, I enjoyed the Hulk movie, but not all of the comic books have translated as well to the big screen as some of them have. And everybody knows how successful the Spider-Man series has been. What's the secret from a great comic book becoming a great movie? You've been involved with both.
Well, I think you have to absolutely capture the flavor of the comic book. And it's not just comic books. When they make a movie of a novel or of a stage play or anything, the most important thing is to figure out what made the original source so popular. What was it that made that something that the fans latched onto, and not lose that quality? Sometimes you make a movie out of a book, but you don't include the one element that made the book successful. And it isn't easy always to tell what that element is. That's the tough part.
What have been the most successful translations of your Marvel comic series into film?
Obviously, I think Spider-Man and the X-Men are the two most successful.
Right. But, I mean, successful, too, as an artistic project, not just as a financial one. I mean, are there other ones that didn't do as well at the box office, but you thought it did capture the spirit of the original comic book?
Well, I thought that Daredevil carried the spirit, captured the spirit.
I
thought
too.
The Hulk did. The only thing about the Hulk, personally, I thought there was a little too much concentration on that business with his father. And I felt it should have been a little bit lighter than that.
Right. I could so see that. Nice artwork, though. I've always loved the art direction on the Hulk.
Oh,
I thought
yeah.
that part was really cool. I really liked how they did that.
Did you know that the Hulk was originally gray in the origin story years ago?
I did not know that. Why was he gray?
Well, you know, I learned that fans, for some reason I've never figured out, fans of superheroes, they love costumes. When I did the Fantastic Four in the first issue, I didn't give them costumes. And we started getting fan mail, and the fan mail read, "We love the book. It's great. We can't wait till the next issue. But if you don't give them costumes, we'll never buy another copy." So with the Hulk, Here I was going to do a story about a monster, and I couldn't think of any reason why a monster would buy a costume for himself. So I figured I'll give him a different color skin. That's the next best thing. And I thought gray would be kind of spooky and scary. But what happened was the printer couldn't print it well. In some pages, he looked like he was dark gray. In some pages, it was light gray. In some pages, it was almost black. So being a comic book editor, you're a little bit like God. You can change anything. So I said, in the next issue, I'll give him a different color. And I looked around, and nobody seemed to be using green for a character. So I said, I'll make him green. And it was just as simple as that.
Well, and I think that's fascinating, too, that you were getting a sort of the interactive input from your fans. Things that people were writing to you in the formative years of those characters, like you mentioned with the costumes, but in other aspects of the character that you incorporated that originally came in just a letter in the mail?
Well, I got so much mail. And more than mail, I did a tremendous amount of lecturing at colleges and universities, and we'd always have questions and answers period. And I learned so much more from the people in the audience than they could ever learn from me. And it's so great. You talk to people who read your books, who care about the books, and they tell you what they like and dislike. So my job was easy. I didn't even do the work. The fans really did it for me.
Well, you know that I preach a little on the side, and every once in a while someone will come up and they'll say something that they heard in the sermon, which I know I didn't say or I didn't think I said, mm-hmm. but they heard it in there and they thank me for it later. And I go, well, that's really cool. Next time I'll do that on purpose. I mean, there are things like that that people catch that you may not have even known that you were putting in there. But
you
obviously
are so right. Now, take the X-Men. I was just originally trying to get an interesting group of characters with interesting powers, and I thought it would make it twice as interesting if the public really didn't like them that much, and if they had to worry about their reception by the outside world. Little by little, I began getting mail saying how great it is that I'm doing these stories about bigotry and the evils of bigotry and so forth, and race hatred. And I guess I was doing that, but I was doing it subconsciously. That wasn't the main purpose.
And when the X-Men enjoyed its reincarnation on film, there was a lot of talk about how this was really a story of homophobia.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
And that was not wasn't part of the original blueprint.
No, it was the furthest thing from my mind.
Right. and so I love those characters. And of course, my kids are big time into them. And I have one son, Itchy, who's read all 8 volumes of the Essential X-Men. I think there are 8 now. They're each
there
on the phone.
There is greatness in that young man.
Yeah. they're each like the size of a small city phone book. And he's read 8 of them. And he can't wait for more. And what he's fascinated with, and what I love about the stories, is how it relates to both the pain of being who you are, as well as the great joy of realizing who you are. And these characters, I think, speak to that kind of adolescent angst.
You're absolutely right. Well, you know, the thing is, every writer who writes anything tries to make the characters as believable as possible and as empathetic as possible. You want the reader to understand the character and care about the character. And in order to do that, you've got to give the character weaknesses. You've got to give the character problems. You've got to show the things that worry the character and torture the character, as well as all of the great things about him. And then you get a real 100% of a person.
So what worried you, and what were you angst-ridden over when you were a teenager that showed up in the comics later?
Well, I think mainly the thing I was worried about was just security. My parents were living in the time of the Depression, and my father was mostly unemployed, and our biggest problem was paying the rent in our little apartment every month. So that was the thing uppermost in my mind. And when I wrote Spider-Man, I guess I wasn't consciously thinking of it, but it must have been in my subconscious because I made Peter Parker a young man whose aunt never had enough money, and he was always concerned about making enough money for her so that she wouldn't lose the mortgage in her home and have to be kicked out of it.
You know, I saw this thing on you or on the history of comic book heroes on the History Channel, which was way cool. Mm-hmm. And I loved the part about how Jewish theology worked its way into some of these superheroes from the very beginning. And I just like, I mean, especially when they were talking about some of the Superman stuff and some of the words that from Krypton were essentially taken directly from Hebrew. And I was like hitting myself going, that is so cool. I don't know why I never made that connection. And I think that's like a whole nother aspect of the comic book experience that we don't even really think about, which is that everybody is sort of shaped by their birth home and how their family of origin treats them growing up and how that ends up getting worked out in the comic book characters. And I found a lot of things that you said in particular during that History Channel piece to be fascinating.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was not aware that there were any Jewish words or similar to Jewish words in the Superman stories. I've got to go back and reread them.
Well, you didn't catch that part. The name, any word that, well, I don't get into it with you, but you go back and see it. And it's interesting, like Kal-El, and all of the way that the names from Krypton end in L comes directly from Hebrew. You get Daniel.
I wasn't even aware of that.
I thought that was the coolest thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. It knocked me out. But so as you look at, you know, as you look at the progression of these comic book characters, and I know that you've worked obviously in a couple, not just for Marvel, but you did some consulting for DC too over the years.
Well, not quite consulting, but a few years ago, we decided just for fun that I would do a few books for them, and I took their characters like Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, the Green Lantern, the Flash, and I wrote different versions of them as though, how would they be if I had created them? And it was just a fun exercise.
What? The Green Lantern has always been one of those characters that always, it kind of almost always made it. But
I'm sorry,
never,
which one?
The Green Lantern.
Oh, yeah.
It kind of was always on the cusp of becoming, I mean, it's legendary, no doubt, but I don't think, I mean, I know they're coming out with some movie on it or something, but I understand it, but I mean, it's just, it seems like it never quite got the traction that the other characters did from that era.
No, I guess not.
Why is some characters catch on in that way and others just kind of not?
Well, it's the same, you know, you could say the same about books, you could say the same about movies, and usually it is simply a case of you have to make characters, I think I mentioned earlier, that the reader or the viewer cares about and is interested in. One of the best examples to me was Sherlock Holmes. I mean, I was so interested in Sherlock Holmes when I was a kid, reading those stories, even if I didn't care who the villain was, even if I didn't care who was the murderer or the robber or whatever, if he wasn't a detective, I would still have enjoyed reading the stories because I found his own personality so truly fascinating. And to me, that's the secret. Now, maybe with the Green Lantern, and I'm not familiar with him, really. I don't even remember his name, his normal name. So whatever it was, maybe the readers weren't that interested in him as a person.
And yet you've had such success with the ones you've had. Are there characters you created that I don't know about because they just didn't catch on, that you thought were going to be a hit and it just kind of didn't?
I hate to say this because it's going to sound terrible, but I really didn't have any that didn't become hits.
No, there are no Green Lanterns in your past, in the sense of,
not that I can think, not since the Fantastic Four, when we started the so-called new Marvel Age. You know, we had called our books by a different name. I think we were Atlas Publishing before then. And after the Fantastic Four and the X-Men, Daredevil and the others, and we saw that we were onto something because the readers loved them, I decided to change the name of the whole line of comics, and we changed it to Marvel Comics. And I must say, every book that we published of a superhero or heroine under the name Marvel Comics, they've all been very well received, and they'll all be movies sooner or later.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I guess I thought there'd be, like, one, you know, there'd be, like, the Blue Bonnet or somebody that never quite caught on or something. But
no, not yet, but give us time.
I don't believe that. I'm sure you won't do that. But I'm sort of intrigued, too, by the idea of the about how the characters have developed and how they've reflected the changes in our cultures. What do you see? And I mean, now that, you know, comic books, as you said at the beginning, were kind of something you were too embarrassed to put your real name on.
Right.
And now it's, you know, mainstream, huge, big, you know, business for all aspects of the entertainment industry and part of our national psyche. What's the future of comic book superheroes or comic books in general?
Well, I think that they'll stay about where they are. You know, years ago, there was no competition at all, except perhaps for movies and the radio. But now you've got television, computers, video games, iPods. I mean, there is so much to occupy people now that comic books are just one of many forms of entertainment. But they are a popular form. They're comparatively inexpensive. They're fun to collect. And they don't take up that much room. You could collect hundreds of them and keep them in a closet. They're fun to share with your friends. So I think they'll always be around. And the big thing is people are so interested in movie producers and TV producers keep scanning the comic books looking for ideas for movies and TV shows. So they'll always be comics just because they form a basis for things in other fields.
Up next, four more special guests who have passed on.